Dr. Bon Miller, this is Bruce Lease. Dr. Bruce Lease, good to have you on the call.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, we have heard such good things about you, and you have such diverse interests that are all relevant to what we do in Division 50, the Society for Addiction Psychology. So we feel fortunate to have you on board. If you don't mind, I think it'd be terrific to have you introduce yourself and tell us about yourself. And there'll be people who have questions, and you are welcome, after you tell about yourself, to launch into anything you like, and I'm sure that we will jump in as the questions arise. So please, after you.
Sure. So I'll just give you a quick background and then kind of jump into talking about cannabis and PTSD, if that works.
That works absolutely well. Thank you.
Perfect. So my name is Marcel Bon Miller. I'm a clinical psychologist. Got my PhD in 2008 from the University of Vermont, and then came out west. I've been at the Department of Veterans Affairs for just over 9 years now. I'm at the kind of three different centers within VA. I'm at the National Center for PTSD, the Center for Innovation to Implementation, as well as the Center of Excellence in Substance Abuse Treatment and Education. And then a few years back, I started a position at the University of Pennsylvania, so I'm kind of bi-coastal, if you will, and have some grants running through there, and continuing my VA job. So, and my expertise and primary interest is in cannabis and PTSD, though, as was mentioned before, I've kind of dabbled in a few other areas, but really mostly cannabis is, and cannabis use is kind of my interest pretty much through all of my research that I'm doing.
Excellent. Thank you for that great introduction. I want to let you know, I don't know if you've been on one of these conference calls where you hear the ding, but every time you hear that sound, it means somebody else has gotten on the line. So there are quite a few people on the line, and there is another one.
It makes me think of that movie. What is it? It's a Wonderful Life. Every time.
That's great. That's great. It does sound like that. It's nice and quiet on the line. Everybody is either has their phones muted or they're in quiet places. Please let me remind everyone to please put your phone on mute, even though it has been nice and quiet. So, Dr. Bon Miller, tell us more about your interest in marijuana and PTSD, please.
Sure. If questions arise, just jump in. It seems like that's the format, which is totally fine. I'll start with just a brief overview. So cannabis, while cannabis is kind of different from a lot of drugs that have been that are used by individuals because it's so heterogeneous. So cannabis is made up of over 100 chemical compounds called cannabinoids. And each of these cannabinoids have different effects on folks. And so the cannabis that one, my line or joke is that, cannabis is not cannabis is not cannabis, meaning that, an individual using quote-unquote cannabis doesn't really help us understand the effects of the drug because we really need to understand what it is that they're using more specifically. And so within cannabis, most of what's been studied and most of what's used is THC, so tetrahydrocannabinol. That's the primary psychoactive component within the plant. And what we see, in dispensaries or general use when people report using cannabis or marijuana, that it's typically a plant that's pretty high in THC. And this is the component or the cannabinoid in the drug that really makes you feel, gets that feeling of being high. But there are others in there. And so another one that's kind of more recently been studied is cannabidiol or CBD. And this has completely different effects from THC, which we'll get into a little bit as we move forward in what I was just going to talk about. But an example being where THC makes you feel high, CBD does not. Where THC can at high doses cause anxiety, CBD has actually been shown to be an anxiolytic. And so it's really important given, and these are just two examples and probably the two most studied cannabinoids at this point within the plant. It's really important to understand the ratio of these different cannabinoids and to understanding its effects and its impact on addiction and disorders generally as a treatment. So first, I guess I thought I'd talk about why individuals use cannabis, because there's a lot of, you know, with this push towards medicalizing marijuana or using it for recreational purposes, you know, a lot of interest in trying to figure out, you know, why is it that somebody wants to use, or why does somebody feel like it's helpful? And a lot of this, as a shout out to South Dakota and Jeff Simons, this is, you know, a lot of this kind of work of really trying to understand the motivation underlying the drug started from Jeff and, you know, trying to think about, you know, adapting and developing measures of documenting reasons why individuals use. And the first shot of this was done kind of using what we knew from the alcohol literature and morphing it over into cannabis and really understanding that individuals, you know, at that point, kind of late 90s, early 2000s, was saying, you know, hey, you know, people use cannabis to enhance their experience, like because it's exciting, to conform or fit in with a group that they like, for expansion reasons, for social reasons, and also for coping reasons, or to forget your worries or to, you know, deal with stress. And what we found with the literature stemming from that assessment is that really it's those folks that are using for coping reasons that are really the most susceptible to having problematic use patterns and difficulty, for example, developing cannabis use disorders, than folks that are using for lots of other reasons. What happened since, in 2011, Christine Lee up at the University of Washington came up with a revised measure that was kind of developed from the ground up and really tried to hone in on lots of different reasons that individuals may cope with the substance. So, for example, individuals using to help with their sleep, individuals using for lots of other different reasons, though that measure was developed from undergraduate. So it doesn't really capture the medicinal use and the reasons why people are using medicinally, if that makes sense, from kind of the traditional medicinal perspective. So what we went about doing is a study really trying to get a handle on medicinal use. This was a study done in California in a medical marijuana dispensary. So in California, medical marijuana is legal, as is the case in now I keep missing count, I feel. So as of a little bit ago, it was 24, but I think it's gone up now, states that have legalized medicinal marijuana. And we were just really interested in honing in on one dispensary, one, you know, in the middle of San Francisco, looking at folks that came in and out of that dispensary and really trying to get a sense of why is it that they're using and are there associations between that use and problems with cannabis. So in this study, which is now was published in 2014 in the American Journal of Drug and Alcohol Abuse, we looked at 217 adults receiving medical cannabis. Mean age was about 40, and pretty demographically representative of the San Francisco area. So pretty well educated, you know, lots of working professionals. There were folks literally, as we were doing recruitment, that would come in suits during lunchtime, smoke a joint, and then go back to work. So it's definitely an interesting population and one to really kind of think outside the box from what is traditionally thought of as, you know, the stoners or things like that. Like these are people that are functioning, and we can talk about that from a diagnostic perspective, but these are folks that are functioning and also using the drug in some cases, not all for sure. When we asked them what the conditions were that they were using cannabis for, the number one, and there have been, ours was probably the third study to do sort of a broad kind of capture of users and try to identify the reasons for medicinal cannabis use. And these are all pretty similar to what have been found in the early work, as well as a lot of studies that have followed. The number one and two reasons that folks reported using cannabis medicinally was for anxiety and for chronic pain, with 61.8% in our sample of anxiety and 58% for chronic pain. And we pretty much see a flip-flop back and forth. It's either chronic pain is number one or anxiety is number one, depending on the sample that you look at, but pretty high rates. of this. And as you even see from those two statistics, so 58% for chronic pain and 61.8% for anxiety, you know, that's more than 100 just with those two conditions. And that's because there are lots of folks that are using for many different reasons. So we see lots of overlap. Other reasons that people reported, we kind of rounded out the top 10, include insomnia, depression, appetite, headaches, nausea, muscle spasms, and post-traumatic stress disorder kind of coming in at about 18.9% of folks using cannabis specifically for PTSD. And again, this is in a community sample of dispensary goers. So given that, given the kind of multiple reasons for use, you know, how prevalent is this? You know, how many people are using cannabis, and how does it relate? How does that prevalence relate to certain conditions? So we know just broadly from the literature, right? Cannabis is the most widely used "quote unquote" illicit substance in the U.S. The reason I put that in quotes, right, is because in certain states it's no longer considered an illicit substance, but federally is. We know that about 19.8 million individuals above the age of 12 have used cannabis in the past month, that about 8.1 million individuals use it daily or almost daily and within the past month, and about 5.7 million are reporting daily or almost daily to used in the past year. And so just to like highlight what that means, we're talking about 5.7 million people in the U.S. above the age of 12 who are using cannabis greater than or equal to 300 days in a year. So there's a large group of individuals here that are regularly or multiple times daily using cannabis. And we also know, and this is kind of as we start to transition thinking about trauma, that use of cannabis is particularly an even higher prevalence among vulnerable populations. So if you get and this is what we see for the medicinal dispensary as an example, but if you get a group of individuals who have PTSD, or if you get a group of individuals that have chronic pain, you're seeing much higher prevalence rates than the general population. So in terms of epidemiological evidence, so if we look at, and I'm now going to transition a bit into PTSD, if we look at, you know, what epidemiological evidence do we have for an association between cannabis and PTSD? There have been kind of two large epi studies. One was with the NCSR, so the National Comorbidity Study Revised. The other was with the NESARC. And both really showed a pretty strong association, and these are samples, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 folks, a pretty strong association between cannabis use and PTSD symptoms, where, you know, a diagnosis of PTSD was associated with a very high and odds of using cannabis, just broadly at the population level. And what we saw in the NESARC was specifically kind of a gradated effect where exposure to trauma, experiencing a criterion A trauma was associated with lifetime cannabis use, whereas a diagnosis of PTSD was associated with a cannabis use disorder. So here the idea, and this kind of lends support for a model where individuals may experience trauma, they may use cannabis initially to cope. That use may, kind of from a negative reinforcement perspective, increase their trauma symptoms. They may over time then start to develop PTSD. And then, you know, continuing to use cannabis to cope with those PTSD symptoms become dependent on the drug. And so that's what we're thinking really is the potential model to go by when understanding the association between cannabis and PTSD. Other epidemiological work that has been done, we've had the fortune of having some great data at the VA, where, you know, we can actually have data sets that have every single person treated at the VA in a given year. And so utilizing that, we tried to understand, okay, so what's the association here? Like, are there certain, you know, what can we learn about veteran as a population that is particularly vulnerable. use of cannabis or other substances. So we did a study, the VA tracks year over year from the Program Evaluation and Resource Center trends in PTSD and substance use. And so what we know is that among veterans seen at the VA, so that's the context, right, because this is only those that are seen at the VA for veteran data, among those with co-occurring PTSD and substance use disorder, we see that since 2009, cannabis use disorder is the number one illicit substance use disorder among folks with PTSD. Before 2009, it was, and I think this is really fascinating from a research perspective, it was cocaine. Cocaine was the number one substance use disorder among folks with co-occurring PTSD SUD. That's just as a sidebar, a really fascinating place that I think there should definitely be a lot of research into, because it seems counterintuitive from my perspective, but I know some folks like Anka Vujanovic down in Houston is doing some work in this area, but really interesting. But then, 2009 on, we're seeing really an exponential growth as cannabis use disorder is the number one illicit substance use disorder among folks with PTSD and SUD. If we flip it, now we're going to look at, instead of folks with PTSD as the primary group, if we look at folks with cannabis use disorders within the VA, so taking everybody with a cannabis use disorder and looking at what are the different rates of psychopathology among those folks that have a diagnosis of a cannabis use disorder, we see that 71.4% of veterans with a cannabis use disorder also have a psychiatric disorder, the number one of which is PTSD. The last data point that we had for this was probably about 5 years ago now, but what we see is about 29%, or just probably now has surpassed 30%, of individuals with a cannabis use disorder seen at the VA having co-occurring PTSD. And that's the number one psychiatric disorder among that group. Now, why does this matter? It matters because, there are lots of individuals that are reporting benefit from substances, and that's where you kind of see in the medicinal use and kind of the proponents of medicinal use. We also know, as was eloquently summarized by Nora Volkow a couple years ago in New England Journal of Medicine, there are lots of consequences of cannabis use. So we know that short-term use of cannabis is associated with impaired short-term memory, impaired motor coordination, altered judgment. In high doses or among folks that have certain genetic vulnerabilities, it can lead to paranoia and psychosis. And in terms of long-term consequences, we know addiction is one, right? I mean, this is Alan Budney's work, among others. Al was kind of one of the first ones to kind of start documenting this now, 15 plus years ago. But we see that addiction is pretty, and I'll get into the addiction piece of this, but we see addiction as a long-term consequence. Altered brain development, particularly among folks that use in adolescence. Poor educational outcome and cognitive impairment, again, among folks that use initially in adolescence. That's really for long-term use, the vulnerable group. And I think some really fascinating work that's gone on in the area of adolescence, just because of the brain plasticity and kind of the impact of using cannabis on that. We also know that there's a little bit debate about chronic bronchitis. Some of the work being debunked a little bit because of co-occurring tobacco use. So definitely not fully a clear answer there. And again, increased risk of chronic psychosis disorders like schizophrenia among long-term users. So given that this is Div 50, and I just wanted to really highlight the piece of cannabis addiction or cannabis use disorder. The biggest kind of shift that happened in this was really between DSM-4 and DSM-5, right? So DSM-4 didn't have withdrawal as a criteria for cannabis use or cannabis dependence, whereas that was added in DSM-5 as a criteria. And what we really see here in terms of withdrawal symptoms is a number of symptoms. So including behavioral symptoms such as decreased appetite, increased aggression, restlessness, sleep difficulty, which I'm going to highlight and just think about as we move forward here, in strange dreams. We also see some mood symptoms like nervousness and anxiety, irritability, anger, much less on the physical symptoms. So it's not like alcohol in that way. There's, you know, a lot of fewer physical side effects or physical consequences of withdrawal. But those do include nausea, tension, sweating, chills, some weight loss, things like that. And we really know, I mean, there's a lot of people that have bucked back on the idea of withdrawal, particularly in the medicinal cannabis community, but we really see this consistently. I mean, this is something that, you know, has a pretty clear time course, with some symptoms lasting as long as a month or a month and a half, particularly the sleep problems. And we know that, you know, as with any withdrawal symptom, what you would expect, it's highly prevalent. Addiction is highly prevalent among the majority of users. Withdrawal closely follows cessation, so it happens with it initiates within the first 48 hours of cessation. It follows a specific time course, like I said, that abates with subsequent drug administration, right? So it really is withdrawal, and these folks are experiencing it, particularly these heavy users of cannabis. So that's pretty much a sense of, you know, what we know epidemiologically, what we know from the perspective of consequences, and really the reasons why individuals are using cannabis. Now, when we talk about folks with PTSD, it's really important to think, okay, among this population, what is it helping with? And this work, you know, why are people using it? I'll say that. Maybe it's a less controversial way of phrasing it. What are people using it for who have PTSD? Let's drill down into that. The first work that was done here was by Bremner and colleagues in the mid-90s. You know, just kind of an initial retrospective cross-sectional sort of study among Vietnam veterans, really highlighting that folks with cannabis use, the folks who are using cannabis, and who have experienced trauma are using specifically for hyperarousal symptoms. We've then kind of followed that with a number of studies and really drilled it down to, it's really sleep. If you ask the majority of folks with PTSD or those who have experienced trauma who are using cannabis, they'll tell you, you know, 9 times out of 10, and we've done this, you know, not anecdotally, but we've also, you know, documented this pretty clearly, is that they're using to improve sleep. And both sleep initiation as well as to reduce nightmares or consequences during sleep. And as you think about, and the reason I wanted you to think about the withdrawal symptom of sleep difficulty is, if this is a natural withdrawal symptom of the drug to begin with, you can imagine that quitting among individuals who use and have inherent sleep difficulties and are using for sleep can be particularly difficult. And so, you know, I think this is contributing to our, you know, observed pretty high rates of co-occurring PTSD and cannabis use disorder. You know, I think bringing it back to, you know, talking about the drug. So that's kind of the landscape. We see that individuals with PTSD have experienced greater withdrawal than folks without PTSD, primarily because I believe the overlap of symptoms, also increased craving, of course, during periods of abstinence. We also see... yeah, I mean, these folks are generally speaking a pretty vulnerable population within this. So now shifting to, you know, what I originally started talking about, which was kind of the heterogeneous nature of the drug and the importance here, you know, the work that has been done preclinically as well as clinically has shown that THC is not only THC appears to be at the moment the component of cannabis that is associated with a lot of the withdrawal symptoms that are experienced, as well as heightened anxiety, particularly in high doses. And so I think what's happening right now is trying to figure out whether there's certain types, but then, you know, the flip side, I'll step back, the flip side of that is that there are other cannabinoids that may potentially be beneficial without some of these side effects. For example, cannabidiol has been shown some cool work on social anxiety, using that to individuals using cannabidiol prior to social, you know, kind of these exposure tasks for social anxiety for treatment, finding that it actually helps reduce anxiety and improve treatment outcomes. There's been some really neat work also showing that CBD can help with consolidation of memory and can help with fear extinction. So it could be used potentially as an adjunct to existing psychosocial treatments for things like trauma or things, you know, for other anxiety disorders. But THC has this kind of vastly different effect that we think might be driving a lot of what we're seeing as negative consequences of the drug, particularly for this population and others. And so right now, research-wise, we're kind of moving towards trying to isolate out pieces of the drug that may confer risk and problems, like cannabis use disorder, from parts of the drug that may actually confer benefit. And so we're doing, so I'll kind of round this out and then stop ranting and open it up for questions. But right now we have a couple studies underway. The most significant to hopefully nail some of this down is a clinical trial of different concentrations of cannabinoids on individuals with PTSD, where we're literally, it's a crossover randomized controlled trial where we have four different drug conditions. The first is high THC and very low to non-existent CBD. The next condition is high CBD and very low to non-existent THC, so kind of the inverse. The third condition is a one-to-one, so equal amounts of CBD and THC. And the fourth condition is a placebo. And this is a multi-site trial where we're really trying to understand, right, are there certain preparations that may be more beneficial while also reducing risk of negative consequences? Because I think from the preclinical work and early clinical work, as well as what individuals are reporting and what we're seeing, the rates of cannabis use among folks with PTSD, I think there is something there from a medicinal and therapeutic standpoint, but there's also, as you know, was described earlier in this, a pretty strong and overwhelming negative consequences, particularly among populations like this. And so the question is, can we mitigate that risk? And I think that's really where some of the field is going at this point, and I think an important part to consider, particularly given the fact that existing treatments for PTSD are have some room for improvement. So I can stop there and open it up, I guess.
Wow, that was terrific. Thank you so much. I really resisted asking questions and was glad I did, because you answered the questions as you proceeded. So I had questions about dependence and symptoms of withdrawal and the extent to which continued use might be a function of avoiding withdrawal, and you hit on all of those. So why don't I just ask those online if they want to jump in with questions? I'm sure they will.
Hey, Dr. David Eddy here from Harvard Medical School. It's really, really interesting work. I was wondering how, in the last clinical trial you mentioned, how are you dosing participants in that study?
Yeah, so we're giving them up to a maximum of 1.8 grams per day that they can use, but it's ad lib, so they can self-titrate. And the reason for
gotcha.
That is because there is no kind of standardized dosing at this point, because it's a function of body weight and all sorts of different things.
And are you using dronabinol or some other
no.
Medication?
We're actually using NIDA-obtained cannabis, so actually the plant material.
Okay, are the participants smoking, or are they ingesting the drugs in edible form?
Yeah, so we had it so that we're for this study, they're smoking it. The reason
right.
we're doing that is because of dosing. Actually, with edible form, it's really, really hard to dose.
Right.
You can have that experience pretty negative consequences because of delayed onset of drug effect.
Sure,
smoking is
sure.
pretty fast onset. So for this study, that's what we did.
And it's probably closer to how people use in the real world, too.
Exactly. I mean, there are definitely other delivery methods that are, you know, coming out, sublingual and things that might be ways of getting acute effects without having to deal with, or kind of quick drug onset without having to deal with potential negative bronchial side effects. But at this point, we don't have all the mixtures of the different concentrations. So like you mentioned, dronabinol, you know, is pure THC synthetic derived, but we don't have a pure CBD that's, you know, that's synthetically derived as another grouping variable at this point that's FDA approved.
Right. And so NIH is producing cannabis for you that has, you know, a very high or THC and sort of little to no cannabidiol and vice versa.
Exactly. Yep.
Gotcha. Great. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm sure there are other questions.
Thanks, Dr. Von Miller. This is Noah Emery from the University of South Dakota. I was wondering if you could, so you kind of talked about how the different components that make up cannabis kind of show trajectory differences in the outcomes that we see. And I was wondering if you could speak to if there's any kind of like gatekeeping effect of these kind of like between-person differences or within-person differences, psychosocial factors that kind of trigger these different trajectory differences in the outcomes.
In terms of effects of differential effects as a function of cannabinoid, is that what you mean?
Yeah, or I mean just like, so, I mean, if like there's, you spoke of some really cool research about how when we parcel apart cannabidiol versus the delta-9 THC, that we show like different effects and those kind of have the different consequences, right? Like one of them kind of has more positive consequences and therefore probably less problematic use patterns. And whereas THC, for instance, has more withdrawal effects, which cascade down into the more kind of substance use disorder kind of qualities and so forth. And I was just wondering if there are, I know some of your work has looked at like, you know, distress tolerance or even maybe genetic factors and things like that that could trigger just your typical user who's using street marijuana and how that kind of cascade would look.
Yeah, so I think, I think in a lot of cases, you know, I would bring it back to like a diathesis stress model where you have, I mean, definitely certain folks that have vulnerabilities that would be, you know, with the use of cannabis would be more likely to kind of go down one road versus another. The best and clearest example probably at this point is what's emerging with psychosis and development of schizophrenia, where you have individuals that have genetic vulnerabilities being, you know, at crazy high risk, even after one use of cannabis for developing, you know, psychosis. But we also see, like you said, other kind of mechanisms that may be driving this for, you know, I think there's some great work that's moving forward in this area on like anxiety sensitivity. So thinking about somebody that has a proclivity to being anxious in certain situations or having just generally a highly kind of anxious personality is, you know, could be significantly higher likelihood after using THC, particularly in high doses, for developing panic or developing other anxiety disorders. So there are definitely some really neat areas of work there, but I just don't, yeah, I think it's still developing. Most of it has been done on anxiety sensitivity and distress tolerance, as you mentioned before. And we'll see. I mean, I think right from a prevention standpoint, really trying to understand these things are important so that we can kind of steer folks who have that high vulnerability away from using because they might be the most vulnerable to experiencing consequences.
Thank you.
This is, again, I'm going to jump in with a question here. This kind of a funky question. What do you hope ultimately you will find? Are you hoping, for example, that we'll find a better alternative to treatment than traditional anxiolytics? Are you hoping that it will be equal to others, but one that might be more, say, palatable to people with PTSD. What would be, at what point would you stop and say, we figured it out?
Well, hopefully not until the end of my career, at least.
What? Sorry, what did you say?
Oh, I said hopefully not before the end of my hopefully not till the end of my career. what I'm expecting and what I think we need is more treatment options for folks with PTSD. Right now we have a couple psychosocial interventions like cognitive processing therapy, prolonged exposure, and they work well for certain segments of the population, but we see really high rates of dropout. We see really high rates of non-response. And from a pharmacological perspective, we're dealing with SSRIs primarily for folks with PTSD, and the effects are really not that compelling. And no great pharmacological treatments for this population. So I think having other options that are available are really what we're trying to do at moving this forward. I think, if we could identify right now, my money's on CBD. Who knows, though? I mean, again, we're, really focusing on 2 of 100+ cannabinoids, which is kind of crazy because, we just did a review of the literature on cannabinoids, on studies of secondary cannabinoids, meaning cannabinoids that, aren't THC. Outside of THC and CBD, I think there were like 5 studies in the past 5 years that did anything else, that studied any other cannabinoid aside from CBD or THC. And part of that is availability of those cannabinoids. Part of that is just lack of preclinical data to start trying clinical studies. But it's definitely a shortcoming in the area. So, yeah, I think at this point, the most compelling evidence in CBD, but who knows? And yeah, moving forward, I think just, really it's about personalized, patient-focused care where we have, a toolbox of treatment, and we can do individualized care and try to find out what treatment is best for what individual. But right now we don't have much in that toolbox. And so if this is one possibility where we can reduce any risk of, dependence, the last thing we need is like a benzodiazepine situation where we have people using something that, they come very quickly addicted to. If there are alternatives here, I think we should really be exploring them.
That's terrific. Thank you. Another question I have is, how do you think, Dr. Volko earlier, how do you think NIDA's attitude about marijuana research is evolving or has evolved over the years since you started this?
Yeah, and I, as a rule, and partly groomed by the VA in this, generally don't comment on policy or policy shifts or kind of my interpretation of them. But I would say, generally speaking, there is, I think, a decent amount of receptivity towards exploring this from multiple angles, not just from a drug abuse perspective. The hard thing is, there's, I've had some conversations with folks at NIH, the hard thing is that, there's not a, NIDA's responsibility is for treating, for focusing on substance abuse and substance dependence. It's not for, identifying illicit substances that could be helpful necessarily. And I think that's where it starts getting tricky into the funding area, where, there are no clear mechanisms, right, for funding a lot of cannabis research that needs to get done. And a lot of times you'd be, maybe NIMH or different things, but I think there's, it's tricky. Funding for this area is really hard. It seems like, NIH broadly is definitely getting the message and interested. They just put out a, that closed, I think, on the 15th of September, they put out a request for information on, what do we need to know about secondary cannabinoids and, what is the availability that NIDA has in their drug supply program sufficient for the research that needs to get done, or are there certain things that are limited or stymied as a function of the what's available and not? So I think they're definitely interested in learning more and supporting it.
Oh, that's terrific. And I appreciate you not worrying about policy, because I really was talking about largely funding, and so you answered a question I didn't even think of talking about the difference between the National Institute on Drug Abuse and other national institutes of health that be more interested in treating disorders with medicine. So that's very helpful. How about the rest of the group before we ask Dr. Von Miller to continue? Anybody else have questions? I'm going to ask you one more. Tell us what you think about Marinol.
Yeah, and this is and I think it brings up a broader issue. So Marinol is THC, right? Synthetically derived THC. Or also known as dronabinol. Lots of, you know, neat work in the area. I think the problem that we're seeing is that there's not a whole lot of patient interest in using it. I think it's changing a little bit for certain populations that have certain medical conditions, as we're starting to realize that THC may be helpful for pain or appetite stimulation or things like that. But you're seeing some folks gravitating toward Marinol because of availability, but this is where we get into an issue of motives, kind of bringing it back, that there's a lot of the population are using for multiple reasons. So while we isolate it out, you know, individual A uses cannabis for coping reasons or uses cannabis for whatever, and that can be causing problems, the reality is that if you look at the population from pretty much any perspective, even medicinal population, they're using for multiple reasons. Now, coping or, you know, reducing symptomatology or whatever might be the primary one, but there are others. And, you know, and so I think that when you talk about, so I think the trick is that a lot of them enjoy using cannabis because in its whole plant form, because they're more apt to experience the kind of wide array of symptoms, both feeling high and feeling, you know, all sorts of different effects from cannabis. But I think that's where you're seeing difficulty with uptake of isolated cannabinoids, particularly THC. Now, we'll see if that changes. I mean, I think that's going to be the trick with, you know, the work on CBD, for example. If it's found to be therapeutic for certain populations, it doesn't, you don't feel high, you don't feel whatever. You know, maybe it's a different population that would engage in it. Maybe there would be difficulties with uptake into it because they don't get these kind of secondary experiences. I think it's really tricky, and there's really a debate in the literature and kind of the field more broadly between kind of plant-derived or synthetically derived cannabinoids. So there are companies that make synthetic cannabinoids like dronabinol and are developing other ones on one side of the fence that are just isolated compounds, right? Like this is THC, period, or this is CBD, period, same structure molecularly. On the flip side, there are folks that say you actually need, you know, to really get benefit and to really have people use it, you need kind of the full gamut of cannabinoids, even if some of them are very low availability within it, from the plant. And so you have companies like GW Pharmaceuticals that are developing cannabis extracts and getting those through FDA for treatment of certain conditions. They're responsible primarily for a lot of the work we know on multiple sclerosis, for example. They have a product called Sativex that's a one-to-one CBD to THC, but it's plant-derived. And they funded, the majority of work on MS that we know in terms of cannabinoids has come from research funding they've done. And so I think, you know, and that's the other argument, that you need this sort of entourage effect, as it's called, of all the pieces of the plant. So we'll see. I know it's a long-winded answer, but it's definitely complex.
It's terrific. How do they do plant derived? How do they make that happen?
Yeah, so GW Pharmaceuticals is an example, and I'm just picking them out of a hat. I have no relationship with them, but they have the largest operation of this worldwide. They're based in England, and they literally grow plants and then extract the cannabinoids. I think they use an ethanol extraction. I think, but there are lots of different ways that you can extract the cannabinoids from the plant. material into an extract that looks like an oil, and that's what's used and delivered in whatever form you would deliver it.
Very interesting. I guess if we can make decaffeinated coffee, we can extract cannabinoids.
Right. Exactly. I mean, they have multiple. There's ethanol and CO2 extraction are the top two, but there's butane extraction and all sorts of different methods that you can use to extract the cannabinoids from the plant material and put it in a olive oil or some sort of other kind of base to hold it and deliver it.
Very interesting. So we only have about 13, 14 minutes left. I'm sure finding this riveting. We could go in a couple of directions. I certainly would say that one direction is another opportunity for other people to ask questions. Would love to hear you talk further about any of this or any more of your research. And I'd like to leave a few minutes at the end to just have you talk about how you manage to get so much done as a researcher, because clearly you're no slacker. And there are
right.
people on.
I want to be. That's why I need a break. Happy to. And what might be helpful, maybe to give a little bit more stimulation for the conversation for a couple minutes, is just to talk about treatment for
sleep
disorders. I didn't talk about that, but I think, and so what I would say is that, in short, treatments for cannabis use disorder don't look a whole lot different from treatments for any substance use disorder. With the primary ones, contingency management, cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational enhancement or motivational interviewing, really being kind of the strong ones from a psychosocial perspective. From a pharmacological perspective, really not a whole lot. There's really nothing that's really bubbled to the top with any strong evidence. People are still digging around, but nothing's really seems that helpful for cannabis use disorders. What we've done, the problem is that those psychosocial interventions that I mentioned, while they're the best that we have, and they're consistent with lots of other substance use disorders, we're finding that, they just don't cut it. I mean, there have been lots of reviews of these interventions, and they're helpful, like a lot of psychosocial interventions, helpful for some, but there's a large population that, lapses or relapses pretty quickly following receipt of these, standardized and well-studied interventions. And so some of the stuff that we're doing in the lab is trying to identify, using this motivation literature of the reasons why individuals are using, to using that and what we've gained from that to inform the development of or modification of interventions for the population. So a quick example is we're doing a clinical trial in the lab led by Kim Babson, who's a faculty here at the VA in our group, that's on cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, right? So if a lot of people are using for sleep, which we're finding, if we give them a sleep intervention, are they less likely to, be motivated to use cannabis? And so she's doing that trial right now, which is really exciting. And I think it's that sort of way of using, really trying to understand the functional nature of the drug, why people are using it, and having that inform kind of the targeted intervention that you pick. Just throwing that out there. But maybe that'll spur some extra little few-minute conversations on treatment.
You've just succeeded at doing that with me. I wonder, you can look at any use disorder, or we can call it addiction. You can look at any addictive behavior and estimate from epidemiologic research stage of readiness to change. So I would guess that people who smoke cigarettes have the greatest number of contemplators or people who are preparing to quit. Alcohol would be different. I think about marijuana, and this is just my imagination, I think about marijuana as a drug that people don't really think they need to quit nearly as much as cigarettes, certainly, and I would think even less than alcohol. If you gather up, 10,000 people with with alcohol use disorder, 10,000 people who are addicted to nicotine, and 10,000 people who have cannabis use disorder. I think the cannabis use people would be least likely to say, "I'm in the higher readiness to change categories." Is there any research on that?
Yeah, there's been a little bit, and we're seeing that also. That I think that's an accurate statement and a hypothesis. I think. And that's where I would argue, you know, the motivational interviewing piece on the front end of any treatment is a smart idea, so that really people can understand that there are negative consequences and kind of really weigh out whether their use and the time that they're spending using, the money that they're spending for use, all of those pieces is consistent with how they, you know, what they want to do with their life. And whether, you know, again, if they're using for a certain symptom, like the only reason that they're using is for sleep, and I'm just using that as a simple example, whether there are alternatives to actually treat that problem rather than continue to, you know, put Band-Aids on it by using cannabis and then, you know, theoretically developing problems over time.
Right, which is the theory of cognitive behavioral treatments, you know, if you provide people with skills, coping skills, they're less likely to need whatever problem they're trying to address with substances.
Right, but I think it needs to be more targeted because I think a lot of these people, I think cognitive behavioral therapy is great, but it's a little more amorphous than, you know, these people are like, I have nausea, I have
right.
problems.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And having to really hit it hard with the best thing that we've got. And for some, it may be cannabis. I mean, not to say, you know, I mean, it really helps with appetite stimulation and it really helps with nausea, you know? So, you know, it's not to say that, you know, there are tons, you know, that alternative is always better, but it's to weigh it out in a meaningful way and get those folks that, you know, can receive other things or more effective treatments to consider those instead.
Oh yeah. It can take months to figure out what, cognitive behavioral targets people really need to aim for with new coping skills versus sleep or nausea.
Right.
Wow, we only have 8 minutes left. I want to throw in here that we're starting a clinical trial this week. We're starting a treatment group for all habits. Here at the University of Kansas, we're advertising it as a habits group, and we've gotten people who've signed up who have problems with nicotine, who have problems with online gaming, and with marijuana, and with alcohol already. So it's going to be interesting not only to see how that group works, but how, you know, how different people with all these different use disorders, addiction problems, present themselves. How they describe what's at the core of their continued use of things they're saying they're trying to quit, including marijuana.
Interesting.
So, other questions. Your bringing up treatment was a good idea, I think. Questions about treatment or motivation for treatment or differences in treatment between marijuana use disorder and cannabis use and other use disorders. Well, you jokingly said that you wish you were a slacker. Tell us about what it takes to be as prolific as you are. So soon after getting out of graduate school, you graduated how many years ago?
Eight.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you do it? You're very busy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what it is. I mean, I think it's, I work a lot. I was having another conversation earlier and also joking with my fiance about it, but I'm always talking about work one way or another, and it's hard to get me off the subject.
Who doesn't want to talk about marijuana, though, right? You can even go to parties and talk about your work.
Right. And I think also just, you know, I mean, a lot of it has been happenstance. I mean, I think, you know, certain opportunities present themselves, and not being shy about taking risks or not being shy about engaging in new collaborations. And, you know, instead of, you know, for me, it's just kind of been, you know, saying yes a lot to opportunities and then kind of seeing where they go. And that's led to, you know, some great partnerships, some great folks in the lab, some great grants. I mean, all of these things is just kind of that and thinking outside the box. I mean, just, you know, trying to think about novel and, you know, kind of take large leaps rather than incremental steps in some areas and kind of seeing where they go. And some of them fizzle out and some of them don't. But it's kind of an entrepreneurial sort of approach, I guess, is the one that I've taken.
I think you're the first scholar I've ever heard use that term, and I've always known it to be true. It really is parallel to any entrepreneurial spirit. Tell us specifically about how you discipline yourself to read as much as you need to read, and how and when you get your writing done.
Right, reading as much as I mean, I think what I love. And I shouldn't say this on the call because there's probably a lot of people on editorial boards on the call. I love to review papers, and I really enjoy that, and I find that as a great way to force myself to be up on everything that's going on, both from new papers that are coming through to, the introductions of papers and, you know, other utilizing other people's work that, you know, where they've cracked their introduction, and I'm like, oh, look, that study came out, I didn't know that, or whatever it is. And I'm actively review for tons of journals. I'm on the editorial board of 6 journals, and I just really enjoy that as a way of keeping my head in the game and forcing myself to keep up with what's happening.
So now you really have to answer my question about scheduling. Scheduling writing. some of us get a review. We're emailed a review request and we agree to do it, and we think, okay, well, I guess I'll take this weekend to do this one. So where do you find the time? And when I say this weekend, I mean like this whole weekend. But how do you manage all that?
I don't know. I mean, I think just by practice, you know, just getting to, you know, I've gotten, you know, with reviews, I get through them thoroughly, but also pretty quickly, and get my thoughts out there. And I don't know. I don't know about scheduling. It's really hard to tell you.
Do you write every day?
I write less than I'd like to now. I find more and more of my job is administrative, and that's hard. And I'm trying to work on that piece because one can get there pretty quickly. With my lab being as large as it is and all the stuff that we've got going on, you know, I find myself taking phone calls and meetings more than I do sitting down and writing. And I love writing. And so that's hard. And I'm trying to craft that out a little bit more. I work all the time.
I think that's one of the most commonly asked questions when people are prolific, is specifically about writing. When do you find the time?
Go ahead.
I want to hear what you were going to say.
No, I find that, you know, removing myself from my office helps. If I'm in my office, I get hit more with stuff, whereas if I'm home, I have more time to write.
Well, this has been absolutely terrific. I want to remind everyone that this is an activity that was begun and continues thanks to Division 50, the Addictions Division of the American Psychological Association. If any of you are not members, we hope you will consider joining. Division 50 is pretty inexpensive to join, and there are a lot of terrific benefits. Among the benefits is the Collaborative Perspectives on Addictions, the conference that's coming up March, because we do it every March. Dr. Von Miller, I hope you will be joining us in March in Albuquerque, New Mexico for our mid-year meeting. It's always a very rich and fun meeting. I can't thank you enough, Marcel Von Miller. You have done some very cool things, and I'm sure everybody was as riveted as me. One person just hung up. You can hear from that unusual clink. Oftentimes people have to run way before this. So you've gotten so many people engaged in this conversation. Thank you, and thank you everyone who called.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Absolutely, our pleasure. Let's stay in touch with any of us. We'd love to hear from you, and I think you'll hear from some of us.
Thanks so much.
Yes, thank you.
See ya. Bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.